Welcome to episode 8 of the Marion Vermeersen podcast. Today I'm talking with my friend Beverly Bryant. Beverly has had a long and varied career. She was a university professor and a dean. She has held various senior positions in industry doing community and media relations and public affairs. She served as an elected member of the New Hampshire House of Representatives, and she has been active in political campaigns. Beverly has been an avid sailor her whole life and sails regularly whenever she gets the chance, and she is a competitive swimmer and triathlete. Beverly, thank you so much for agreeing to sit down and talk with me today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you, Marion. It's a wonderful opportunity.
So you've been a student of government and politics for many years. How'd you get interested in government?
Well, I've been interested in government probably for as long as I can remember. I was raised in a very political household. In other words, by political, I mean that there was a lot of talk about politics in my household. And I guess from what I think about now that my dad was involved in Republican circles in Long Island when I was growing up in the 1940s and 1950s. And he had many, many opinions, all of which he shared. He was a very conservative Republican. And he read the New York Times every day, which is the most liberal paper probably in the country at that time and perhaps even today. And he also read the Wall Street Journal. But, of course, we had to know about things. We had the New York Times was our only paper. We had to read it from the time we were quite young. And we looked to politics as something that was interesting and something worthwhile.
I think now you're a Democrat. How did you get from your parents being conservative Republicans to your, you know, and I think you said you supported Eisenhower as a kid. How'd you get to today?
I did, actually. You know, I was raised in the 50s, and as a little girl, Eisenhower was president. And when you know the president, you think he's the best president ever, which I did. We always wore Republican buttons because that's what we were given as our parents were involved in campaigns. And when I went to college, I began finding out that there was another way of thinking and learned, of course, from many very liberal professors who pointed out things that I hadn't heard before. And when I finally did decide to enter politics, I was actually in my 40s and I was living in New Hampshire. And it was clearly very obvious to me that the Democratic Party was one that I would support. The irony of all of this is that my father would never even tell his friends that I was running for state legislature. He was so embarrassed that I was running as a Democrat. But I must say that I'm a fiscally conservative Democrat. Maybe you'd call me a blue dog Democrat today and hopefully in a more intellectual sense than that's usually used. But I really believe in social action and open social action policies, but more conservative economic framework.
So how did you end up running for the New Hampshire House of Representatives?
Well, it was really a fun thing. I had taught political science for years. I had earned a PhD when I was in my 20s and had a job teaching political science. Oh, golly, I taught during my 20s, and then when I got a PhD, I had taught. And I moved to New Hampshire. I was married to a man who worked for General Electric, and we traveled and moved around the country quite a bit, and we ended up in New Hampshire, and I was teaching at the university and teaching on a part-time basis. And somebody said, well, you really should run for office, and one just can't do that. I needed to volunteer. So I wanted something to do to apply my learning, and I ended up asking the town, which was a very small town of about 1,000 people, what I could do, and they were opening up a new conservation commission and asked me to join, and I did and was a member actively for 3 years, and then was appointed to the planning commission and served on that. And finally, there was a 10-year, every 10 years, New Hampshire runs a constitutional review of its constitution, a constitutional convention. And I decided to put my hat in the ring, which I did, and I won. And I loved it so much, I said, well, golly, this is an election year. Maybe I should run for a seat in the legislature. And I did, and I won, and that's how I got in.
Wow. So looking back on it today, what do you think you learned from the experience?
Well, I learned it's about people. And I learned that the important thing for anybody who's in politics is to understand where he or she has come from and what the interests of constituents are, and to keep in touch with them. One of the real advantages of going into politics in New Hampshire and a small community, I had a town of 1,000, as I said, but the district was a multi-member district, so overall there were about 15,000 people in the district. Again, that's very, very small by any California standards. But the people were around me. They would call me. They would talk to me. I had to be in touch with them and listen to their concerns. And that, I think, was one of the biggest messages, is that legislators of any kind, from, you know, planning commissioners who represent, you know, people of the community, all the way up to the highest government officials, are really representatives of the people, and they need to act that way.
Do you think that even in, you know, in California or in big districts today, that the successful candidates still do that well?
That's a good question. I think that there's a great remoteness today, particularly in California, which is rather the antithesis of the retail politics of New Hampshire. People are governed, I think, by what they see on TV and the sound bites that they have, and very often they don't even know their local representatives, of congressional representatives in particular, and they probably don't know who represents them at the state level at all. They've never met the people. I don't know how it's possible to vote for them, but somehow there are votes cast, and there is not the degree of being in touch that there is in New England even today. I think that there needs to be a lot of work on this, and efforts have been made by congresspeople to have town hall meetings. Again, getting people to these meetings and taking time from their ordinary concerns is often tough. And we saw this summer that during the controversy over health care and a lot of other issues, many of the representatives canceled their town hall meetings, doing them perhaps by video conferencing or something like that to avoid actual direct contact with constituents.
What do you think is going to happen with the health care debate?
I think, frankly, the health care debate will be compromised, as all legislation really is. It's a matter of people bringing one side of questions and the other side of questions, and that working them out in conference committees. We've seen the House pass a piece of legislation, and the Senate has too. And now the real work is being done behind the scenes, that we, as observers from far, will not see. There are a lot of interest groups that are involved. There are a lot of discussions in those committee meetings. And I think line by line, staff is going over those pieces of legislation. And they will bring forward a bill probably after the first of the year that will contain some kind of public option and some kind of compromises that will enable at least some of the Republicans to vote for it and to bring the Democrats, who are very wary, back into the circle, because that's what's needed in terms of next year being an election year.
Right, right. Well, living in New Hampshire had to be a unique perspective on presidential elections. What was that like? Did you meet a lot of candidates? Did you learn a lot about presidential elections from that, do you think?
Well, you know, I just had a great time. When I got there, I realized here I am in the state where the primary is first. It's the first primary. New Hampshire is very, very protective of the fact that it is the first real primary. Iowa has its caucus, which has become much more focused, particularly with Obama having won it this year. But in New Hampshire, there's a real presidential primary. It's really retail politics at its best. A person who wants to can meet any candidate of any party at any time, as long as they do that before the candidate becomes nationally known. they're in the state 2 years before any election. I mean, I mean the candidates for president, the real candidates for president. And there are opportunities at town meetings and at fairs and public events to meet candidates and to talk to them one-on-one. One of my great disappointments was I didn't act in New Hampshire at the beginning of 2008, when I could have met President Obama, then now President Obama, when he was just walking around the state talking to real people. I have friends who actually sat with him for 3 hours at a kitchen table and discussed foreign policy. They had that opportunity because they lived in the middle part of the state. They were active, fairly active in politics, but he was listening to the people in a real sense, and that was important. We did meet quite a few candidates. I met Jerry Brown when he was running for president in 1979. He ran in 1980. He did not get very far in the campaign, but he was in his living room in Dover, New Hampshire, and I just couldn't believe it. Here I was meeting the governor of California, who was running for president in the state of New Hampshire. My daughter also shook hands when we were with John Glenn when he ran in 94. I worked on the Gary Hart campaign, who ran again in 84 in the primary. When I say the campaign in New Hampshire, as far as people in New Hampshire are concerned, is the primary. And that is the election they focus on because that's the one most important for that very small state.
Ah, okay. So was it really hard to go from working sort of on the government side to working on the business side and to moving into, representing companies? And I don't know, would you say you were working as a lobbyist? Is that an accurate statement? Or?
Well, I took up that lobbyist mantra in the last few years of my career, which is very funny because the euphemism for what I do is called government relations and or community relations in some cases, but really government relations. And the reason we took up the lobbyist mantra was the following. The city of San Jose decided that anyone doing government relations would be officially designated as a lobbyist. And we had to register and we had to pay a fee to be a lobbyist and declare our clients and declare in broad numbers how much they paid us. And all of us who were doing government relations for companies or, in my case, for a business association, professional association, were incensed by this because we were on salary. We were using we got paid whether we were successful or not, and we didn't get retainers and we didn't get extra money for doing good deals. We were just merely trying to represent the economic interests. And by business associations, I mean people like myself. I was running an association for home builders. I was working with people like the president of the executive director of the Chamber of Commerce of various cities and so on. And we all had to register as lobbyists. But I think the biggest thing, in answer to your first question, which is how did I make the transition from government to business, was that having had some experience in business, I did some consulting for General Electric, and I've been married to a man who was a businessman and understood business issues, is to know that I knew the public side. I knew what were the constraints on public officials and what were the concerns that they had to deal with in their own constituencies. And I also could understand, because I had the people with whom I was working teach me what their interests were and what their concerns were. And my job was to simply try to point out to each group what the other was really interested in, and to see if we could effect some compromises that would move public policy forward.
Interesting. Okay, I guess that makes sense when you think about it. If a young person was interested in getting involved in government and public policy today, what advice would you give them on how to prepare or how to get started?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the first thing I'd do is teach them to study a broad range of subjects in college. I see so many young people, and I have over the course of my career, who have come into my office and said, I have a degree in political science, and now I want to do politics. And what they have not realized, or perhaps no one's pointed out to them early on, is that in order to do politics, you have to have a pretty good understanding of a lot of different things. One of them being math and statistics and understanding how the economic system works, not only in our country, but perhaps in other countries. But learning how to read a balance sheet is a very important thing for somebody who's into politics. The other thing I think is just to have a good basic background in political theory and understand why people have thought the way they do. What is a liberal? What is conservative? What does this mean in the whole perspective of things? To know something about history, not only history of their state, of their country, of other countries of the world, to have lived perhaps in other cultures and other societies, be through internships or years abroad during college years, and to speak another language. Here in California, if you speak Spanish, you're one leg up in terms of dealing with many, many of the people in the state, and to be able to appreciate other cultures as they might impact their own. So I think a broad understanding of a lot of different things is really the most important thing, and to focus just on political science as such is perhaps a mistake, because it's much more than that. It's really about life and about living.
As a former college dean, what do you tell kids about getting the most out of a college education?
Well, I tell them, I think, first of all, is be ready to be there. I had the best students I ever taught in my life were the young men, and it was men in those days, in 1972, 1973, 1974, who came to Old Dominion University, which was in the city of Norfolk, Virginia. And Norfolk is the largest naval base on the east coast of the United States. These guys came out of submarines, out of carriers. They had been in Vietnam. They had been at sea or at war for 4 years. They were on the GI Bill. They came into my class. They sat down. They got their work done. They were responsible about doing their studying, and they graduated. And the reason was, is they were more mature. They realized the value of the education that they were being given. And they realized that they had really an opportunity to change their lives through education. Many young 16-year-olds or 17-year-olds who leave 13 years of education, K through 12, just don't realize what college can do for them. And my wish always is that we had a gap year like they have in England or in Britain, I guess, in which a student takes off between the high school period and college. Or we had 2 years of public service that were mandated for every student graduating from high school. That way, a student would come to college really prepared to learn and study and be willing to think about how he or she is going to move forward with life.
How do you advise students who are trying to decide what to study in college?
I think, Marion, the most important thing for any student is to do what he or she absolutely loves, what brings them joy and is really what many people will call a great passion. And if you love art or if you love music, you should learn how to play well, and you should try to do that and do that in a way that, you know, you can make money on it later on and make it a career. And I've got a perfect example in my own family. I have a son who is a potter, he's an artist, and he's a musician. And when he went to college, in high school, he did pottery. When he went to college, he was involved in art. And then he picked up the idea of incorporating the music that he had done all his life into actually making a career of it. And he is now a very successful entrepreneur. He's got his own guitar school. He teaches guitar. He's a wonderful teacher. He has students from all ages of, you know, young children as well as adults. And it's, I believe, because he has a passion for what he's doing. And I think that's the most important thing. There will always be funding at some source, from some source, to get money to be educated if you really can demonstrate that you want to do it and that you really have a hope that what you do is going to be good. And when you are doing something that you're absolutely passionate about, it comes through. It comes through to the buyer of the services. It comes through to the people who listen to you and who enjoy, you know, learning from you. They know that this is something that you really care about. And I think that one thing that Christopher has really demonstrated.
Oh, that's fascinating. I think so often you get the advice of, you know, find something that's going to be a profitable way of studying and you're right. If you don't enjoy what you're doing, it just doesn't work very well.
It doesn't. And I think that one way to find out if you enjoy what you're doing is to try everything. You know, just go ahead and try different kinds of things. Even in subsequent jobs after graduation, that often leads to work that you never thought you would do when you had a college degree in hand and were setting out in the workforce.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. I imagine you never thought you'd end up working in corporations doing, government relations either, I suppose.
I never thought I would do that. I was just the furthest thing from my mind that would be something that was even a field that was open to me. And I think that what I've been able to do and what many people are able to do is to, you know, take the learning that we have and then apply it to new situations and to keep on learning. And yeah, something that is very important for all of us to do.
That's so true. Now, you were the first dean at Old Dominion, first woman dean at Old Dominion University, right?
I was.
And I know you taught women's studies, and of course, both of us have lived through enormous changes in the role of women in society. Do you have a perspective on that change that you can kind of articulate?
Well, you know, I've thought about it an awful lot. I've got a daughter who's in her late 30s now, and thinking about students that have grown up not knowing about anything other than Title IX. They understand that women are given equal opportunities with men. They know that if they want to, they can graduate from law school and so on. When I went to college in 1959, it was the late 50s, and women were taught that their role in lives was to get married, to support a husband in the sense of being a backup team for the real breadwinner of the house, which was going to be the husband, and to raise children that were polite and well-educated and were quiet and knew what they their place in the family. And that was the role of the family was paramount, and that was what we were taught. And yet at the same time, in 1959 and 1963, when I was being educated in college, we were being given courses that were equivalent to courses that were taught at Harvard. We just couldn't go to Harvard because Harvard was only women. It was only men. Actually, Harvard's a bad example because they did have Radcliffe. But we couldn't go to Yale. We couldn't go to Princeton. I went to Mount Holyoke, which was the women's Ivy League colleges, one of them. But they weren't thought of as the same. But they were the same. We were taking the same kinds of courses and curriculum, and we had very, very good professors. And yet we were not given ambitious goals for life. We were told that we could go to Catherine Gibbs Secretarial School. We could become nurses. We could become teachers, but we could not become managers. We could not become lawyers. We could not become doctors. In the class of my graduating class, there were 65 of us who were in the political science arena. No one went to law school. No one went
Wow.
to law school. No one was encouraged to go to law school. No one did. Subsequently, we have a large number of our class members who did go on to law school and did become lawyers. We also have ones that became doctors, and we have others that became business managers and people who worked for the government and were very, very successful. But they did that after they got out into the working world, and every step they had to take was very carefully thought out because they were really breaking new ground. The Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan's seminal work on the role of women, was published 4 months before we graduated. And as we were studying for our final comprehensive exams, we were reading it and wondering about this dichotomy between what we had were experienced in the world as we saw it then and what Friedan was really talking about. And subsequently, I think we began to live the changes and to push through some of the barriers to women in many, many fields. I was the first woman to finish my master's degree program in government at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas, and I was the first woman to finish my PhD program at Arizona State University. So, and the first woman to be hired in the department at Old Dominion University, and that's first woman dean. So there were a lot of firsts that we were able to effect, but it only took a lot of hard work and pursuing goals.
It's an exciting time. It's just really, I don't know, I really enjoy looking back on it. I know the Feminine Mystique had an impact on me that just it's hard for people, kids today, to understand, to appreciate, I think, because of just what things were like back then. So, so I know your undergraduate degree was in history. I think you're still fascinated by history, aren't you?
I really am. I just love it. In fact, I've almost made a resolution that I'm not going to read any more books unless they're accurately true historically. And by that, I mean, we have a limited amount of time to read, you know, as we age. I don't read quickly, and I like a good novel, but I'm also really interested in how people acted and what they did, and the research that's come out on historical people and in history. I spent a long time reading a lot of history of women, particularly women who'd crossed the country in the Gold Rush period, women who'd come to California and suffered in the Sierra Mountains, and how they had lived and how they had raised their families. Now I'm on a kick about the American Revolutionary period. I just finished Joseph Ellis's book on George Washington, and so much of the new research is just not dry. It's just like reading a novel. It's fascinating. It's well documented, and it comes in many cases from real letters and documents at the time that perhaps were not available earlier. The Revolutionary period and new founding of the United States period is very interesting. I'm about to read another book on Aaron Burr, one of the other founding early founding fathers, as well as one, and I'm working on one again, another Ellis book on the founding brothers, which is about many of the Revolutionary War and early government leaders in America.
It's funny, I've had the exact same thought that there's only so many books I can read in a year. Truth is better than fiction in a lot of ways when it comes to excitement, I tell you. When you think about history, and I'm sure coming from an academic background where the part of the fun of history, I'm sure, was discussing it and having that interchange with other intellectuals about it. Do you get any of that now? Is there a way to be a better amateur historian, do you think?
Well, you know, I have an ironic situation in my family. My son-in-law is a veterinarian, but he lived in Philadelphia for all his life. His family still lives there, and he's fascinated by this Revolutionary War period because, of course, Philadelphia was really central to a lot of what happened. And so he and I trade books a lot and talk about it to some extent. I miss it in terms of discussions, because lots of people, particularly women, prefer to read novels and so on. But Dave and I trade books back and forth, and that's lots of fun. And also, I talk, ironically, to my grandchildren a lot about it. I'm reading a book now about Roeblings. The Roeblings built the Brooklyn Bridge, and being a New Yorker and having traveled that bridge an awful lot. And very often I will read something, and then I will explain it in stories to my 6-year-old grandchild, a little boy, who is quite interested. You can do a lot with kids, I think, in intriguing them about history by just taking the real stories and, you know, sort of not watering them down, but making them more the simple, and then telling him about, you know, things that happen. Of course, little boys like battles and stuff like that. I don't know how he's going to do on the Brooklyn Bridge building, but I'll work on that.
Now, that makes so much sense. What do you think is the secret to keeping learning throughout life?
You know, I think the thing to keep learning about life, the secret to learning about life is simply to keep doing and to keep asking questions and to keep being open to being able to discover new things. One of the things I love to do is to travel. And I have an opportunity in January to go to Egypt. Well, I know nothing about Egypt. I mean, I know a little bit about Egypt. I took a Middle Eastern history course 50 years ago, but that was a long time ago. I've just bought, you know, the list of books that were recommended for this tour that I'm taking, and I'm going to read them. I mean, I'm going to try to learn a little bit before I go. And then visually seeing the places that I will read about, I think is going to imprint it in my mind a lot better. I think I am a very visual learner, and if I see something, I can learn it quickly. And I think it's being open to new opportunities to do things. I've recently taken a role in our homeless pantry at our church. We feed the homeless, Los Gatos, every week on a Tuesday, and I've had great fun, you know, not only serving food and preparing some food for that, but also to meet with these people and to take some pictures. One of my little roles has been as a photographer, and so for Christmas we're going to take pictures at our Christmas event, and then in January I will put those in little paper folders and give each guy a picture of how he looked on that particular day, and try to do some portraiture. So making opportunities to go to different lectures and different discussions, I think, helps me to learn. And just to keep my mind active by talking to people and trying to find out what they're doing.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, so now, in addition, I know you've sailed pretty much your whole life, haven't you?
I have. That is my, talk about passions. That's my absolute passion in life, I've decided. I wasn't very good at articulating passions for a long time, but I've decided when I get in my little tiny sailboat and sail, I am the happiest person that I could be at any particular time. I've sailed since I was 6 years old, and now that's 61 years, and maybe I'll be fortunate to sail for another 20 years or so.
So how did you learn? I mean,
well, you know, my dad had a boat during the in the 1930s, I guess, before I was born, in the 1940s during the war. And I think actually they used it, my parents used it as sort of a patrol boat. There were submarines on off Long Island, and I think they were out there sort of looking for them. I don't know. But after the war, they did sell it, but they also took me down to a little yacht club that was just forming on Great South Bay, not too far from our home, and enrolled me in sailing lessons. And the boats that they had for sailing teaching were the same boat actually I have today, not the same boat, but the same model. It was a 12-foot gaff rig catboat, little 6 feet wide and 12 feet long, and very, very safe for children. And I got in that boat, and I never wanted to do anything else. I just needed them to drive me down there so I could take more sailing lessons. And by the time I was 9 years old, I was able to skipper the boat by myself and participate in races. And I think by the time I was 11, they let me, well, probably 10, I guess, I could go out into Great South Bay and sail. And the only rule that I had, my parents had, which is amazing when I think about it today, I could sail in an open body of water, make my own decisions about when I was going to go sailing, and I could even go by myself. Only thing I had to do was to be home before dark, or my father and mother threatened to call the Coast Guard. I don't know what. At the same time, my dad, who was afraid of horses, wouldn't let me ride a horse. But to put a small child, a young girl particularly, out in a boat by herself, and give her carte blanche to go sailing all day was quite amazing. And I did that for many, many years. And was disappointed if I had to work in the summer. I was a camp counselor, and those days I had to work, I couldn't go sailing.
Oh, boy. So what's the name of your boat?
The name of the boat is Hardback, H-A-R-D-B-A-C-K, and it's actually an acronym for the first initial of the first name of the people in my family. And we have a great time in Hardback because I'm teaching my grandchildren now how to sail, and they sail in Hardback. They've sailed in Hardback since they were very, very small. But now, this year, this past summer, being 4 and 6, they're more able to steer and to understand how boats move. And we're, my daughter and I particularly, and some of their friends go also, so their mothers. We'll take the children out in the boat and teach them how to do things, how to be the skipper, how to be the crew. It's going to be a couple of years, but by the time they're 8 years old or 9 years old, they'll probably be sailing Hardback by themselves. And I have another little dinghy, a small 9-foot catboat also, a sailing dinghy that we'll put two of them together in the water and have races. So we'll have a good time.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, do you enjoy sailing in the Bay Area? You learned all, obviously, on the East Coast, so.
I learned on the East Coast, and the Bay Area sailing is quite a bit more complex and formidable. I think that's the biggest word I could use. The wind is very, very strong. It's much more erratic. There's far less place to cruise, and it's far less peaceful sailing. I've been able to go a good bit. I belong to the La Scottish Yacht Club, and friends have invited me to go with them for a week. I have one friend who will you know, get a whole bunch of people together and we'll charter a boat and go sailing in the afternoon. So I've done some sailing here. I've also gone back to the East Coast. Last summer I did to go sailing on an old schooner and what they call a headboat. You pay money and you can ride on a scooter for a week in the coast of Maine. And then was invited by some friends to sail on their boat. So I do get opportunities to sail. I have to really make them myself, other than my own little boat in the reservoir.
Oh, that's great. So you've also, I know, done some triathlons. How did you get involved in that?
Oh, triathlons. This is such a funny story. My daughter, triathlons are relatively recent inventions, and in 1991 my daughter started doing them. She's a great athlete. She was a number one swimmer in the state of New Hampshire when she was 12 for the breaststroke, and she ended up coming out here. We moved out to California. She ended up as a All-American water polo player at UC Santa Cruz 2 years in a row. So she's still continues to be an excellent and superior athlete. I mean, superior athlete. She's really sub-professional. Anyway, she started doing them in 1991, and I thought, well, you know, that's an interesting thing. I was going through a terrible divorce, and I thought, well, I can swim, and I can ride a bicycle, and I can walk if I can't run. I mean, those are the three things you do. So I decided to go with her, and I was scared at first, but we went, and she helped me along, and I did one, and I got really hooked. I'm not the kind of person that's going to be number one at everything for sure, and I'm not willing to practice an awful lot except when I'm under the terror of having a race coming up. So I was fine in the swimming. I've been doing this for now almost 20 years. I'm great in the swimming, and I can keep up on the bike. And then we come to the run, and I refuse to run because I've got terrible knees. I have two knee braces, one on each knee, so I walk the run course, which, of course, puts me at a very, very delayed time for finishing. And for years, I did have done one or two a year. That was my goal. I started when I was 51 doing them quite, you know, routinely. I decided I will do one a year until I'm 81, and then I'm going to quit. Mm-hmm. Well, I've kept that role pretty much. I've missed a couple of years, one because I was in the hospital, and two, I was in a place where I couldn't get into a triathlon. That particular year, I was on the East Coast. But I've had a great time with them, and for years I won medals, not because I was any good, but because I was the only one in my age group. So if you're the only person over, you know, between 60 and 65, they give you a prize no matter what. Well, that's sort of stopped, because now many women are doing team and training and other triathlon trainings. It's becoming very fashionable to do triathlons. So I'm not willing to do all that work to beef myself up. So now I'm not winning prizes anymore. And then my family points out to me that if I don't get busy, my prize days are over.
Well, you still swim competitively, not just in triathlons, right? You've mastered swimming in the Senior Olympics. Is that right?
Yes, I do. Actually, I haven't done any master swimming recently, but I did that when I was in my 40s. But now I'm doing Senior Olympics, which is great fun. It's a wonderful program. I'm able to compete in the 2003 Senior Olympics in Norfolk, Virginia, and go back and see a lot of old friends, by the way. And then this past year, the National Senior Olympics were held in Palo Alto at Stanford. I also qualified in the two intervening periods, but one of the times I was ill, and the other time my granddaughter was about to arrive, and I chose my granddaughter over the Senior Olympics. It was a good decision. But this year I swam in three swimming events at Stanford. I never do well. I mean, I come out middle of the pack. By that I mean, if there are 24 swimmers, I'll come out about number 12. And, you know, if there are 27, I'll be, you know, 14 or 15. And it's just been fine. And then I did do the triathlon in the Senior Olympics this year. And there were nine entries in my age group, 65 to 69. And one of the women didn't go around the bike course quite as many times as she should have. So she was disqualified. So I got an eighth place ribbon, even though I took forever to finish. But I had a great time, and it was quite challenging. We swam at Red City in the harbor, and we had a long bike course over at Redwood Shores, and then a run, which I walked over there too. So I love that. I mean, it's just fun to do these kinds of things, and the people I meet during these events are just great people. They're people that you know, are exercising, they're lively, they're quote seniors, but they sure don't feel like it, and they are very, very competitive.
That's great. So, and we were talking a little bit before about, you know, having a philosophy of retirement, and that's maybe making it too formalizing something. But would you say you have a philosophy of retirement?
Well, you know, I think I thought about this because you asked me this question a long while ago, and I thought, I don't know if I've got a philosophy or not. I think the best thing to do is to live every day and don't waste one of them. One of the sad things has happened, and it's just the last couple of years. I've had a lot of friends, many of whom are older than I am, many of whom are younger, but I've had at least 12 and probably more friends die in the past 18 months. And it's frightening because I realize that they are no longer with us, and I need to take advantage of every minute that I can. And one of the things I don't feel like I'm busy enough. I think I have to, you know, gin up my activities and do a little bit better at being more planful about what I'm doing with the hours and days and years that I have, to make sure I really take advantage of retirement. So I think the basic philosophy, and I've got a couple of projects that I'll tell you about, that is don't even waste one day. Don't waste even one day. Life's a gift, and I really need to make the best of it. It sounds a little hokey when people say that, but I think when you see people who were with you last week or last month and are no longer there, you realize that's the case.
So that's so true. So what are the projects?
Well, I think there are two sort of interesting projects. One I've had in the back of my mind for years is trying to photograph and visit all of the state capitals in the United States. When I was in New Hampshire, I was in the legislature, of course, and that legislative capital is one that was built in 1819. It's the oldest existing capitol building in the United States, and it's very, very historic, of course, and was quite significant. And I thought, you know, here I am in Concord, New Hampshire, and I've seen this capital, and actually I'd seen them in a number of other eastern states when I was younger. So I began to count how many I had done, and then I actually, with intention, began to go to cities where I could see state capitals, like in Nevada, and you know, just making sure that when I visited a state, I tried to see the state capital. And take some pictures and just enjoy the fact that I was there. So I've done about 25, and I've got 25 to go. And the areas that I'm really missing are the middles of the country. It's a part of the country that I've not lived in personally. I've lived in 10 states all around the country, but mostly on the littoral, on the east or west coast. And so what I need to do is to go in some of the Midwest states and really make an effort to see the state capitals in those parts of the world. The other thing that's interested me recently, and it's because we hear a lot about this, is that presidents, the more recent presidents, are having presidential libraries. I've been to the Reagan Library, I've been to Jimmy Carter's library. I really would like to do more about seeing some of the presidential libraries because they are really historical museums to the time of the president, which they honor, and I'm going to do that. And the second big project is I have a collection of memoirs that my grandmother, who was born in 1869 in a rural part of Canada in the province of Quebec, wrote. She was a very literate woman. She had a college degree, which is so unusual for somebody of that age, and she had been a teacher before she got married at 30, and then she had my mother, and my mother actually had both a bachelor's and a master's degree in the 1920s. But my grandmother wrote a history of her life from the very youngest days till, I guess, really almost the 1920s. So it's almost a 40-year span that spans the part of the late 19th century before automobiles were even done. And she talks about, you know, riding through the countryside, riding to school in a sleigh in the winter covered by buffalo robes. And I'm trying to put that on a computer and so it can be shared with my sister who has a facsimile copy, but I really want to make sure it goes down for posterity, for my children and for my grandchildren. And it's a I'd started it not too long ago thinking, well, this will be easy. You know, I type pretty fast and I'll go quickly. Well, it's taking a long time. And I'm just going to have to realize that this will have to be a gift that I will give to people perhaps next Christmas, not this Christmas.
Wow, that just sounds fascinating to do. I'm sure, too, as you read it, it makes you ask a whole bunch more questions about things you want to know about that period, right?
It does. It does. And the sad part, again, is that my grandmother actually came to live with us in 1949 when I was a young child. But, you know, when you're a young child, you don't realize the questions that should be asked. And I remember her clearly. She eventually had dementia and had to be in a nursing home. But I do wish that I had taken more advantage of this. My mother always used to say when I was cross with my grandmother for something that your grandmother knows more than you will ever know. And now I realize, of course, she did know more than I will ever know. And she was a very, very intelligent and thoughtful and dignified woman.
Oh, that's great. This has just been fantastic, Beverly. I've so much enjoyed talking with you, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Marion. You're one of my very, very special people in life, and I mean that. You've always been a light in the horizon, and someone that every time I visit with, I feel I know more and learn more, and I wish you all good luck with this program of yours. It's a very bold venture, and I just can't wait to hear the other people that you interview.
That ends Episode 8 of the Marion Vermeersen Podcast. I'd like to thank Beverly for taking the time to have this conversation with me. She is a truly amazing woman. The music at the beginning and the end of the show is the Latin Project playing Dizzy Gillespie's jazz standard, A Night in Tunisia. If you have feedback about this show, please email me at marion.vermeersen@gmail.com or put a comment on my podcast blog at marionvermeersen.blogs.com/mv-podcast. Thanks for listening.